Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Berlin Wall came down, and Europe shone so bright. The big EU, the euro. And now a fall. Debt has knocked Greece off its feet. Now Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Italy, even Belgium are getting the cold eye. And the European dream in big trouble. Timothy Garton-Ash was famously there as the Cold War ended, and he's there as the EU wobbles. This hour, On Point, the fate and future of Europe with Timothy Garton-Ash. And we'll hear this hour from economist Simon Johnson. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Timothy Garton-Ash on Europe's struggle today? You can also comment on our website at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Journalist scholar Timothy Garton-Ash has been following Europe's arc since Cold War Gdansk shipyard days in the 1970s. Famously wrote of Eastern Europe and Velvet Revolution in The Magic Lantern. He's now professor of European Studies at Oxford. He joins us from there today. He's writing for The Guardian and the New York Review of Books. His new book, a collection of essays on the opening years of this century, is Facts Are Subversive, Political Writing from a Decade Without a Name. It's great to have him with us. Timothy Garton-Ash, welcome. Wonderful to have you.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
We're getting you into the studio there, I guess, as we speak, but we're glad to have you. You're writing late.
Very nice to be with you from a rather frozen Oxford with a traffic jam behind me, but okay. I'm here now.
Speaking of frozen, you're writing about the emergence, a little bit facetiously, but not exactly, of something like a new Hanseatic League, maybe instead of the EU. What are you thinking of there, Timothy?
Well, I mean, listen, the European Union is the most amazing success story. I mean, compare what's happened in North America over the last 40 years with what's happened in Europe. We've seen the liberation and the unification of our continent. It's rather like the last 40 years of the 18th century for North America. And having almost united the whole continent, we now face this first great crisis, which is the crisis of the eurozone, of the single currency.
Is it, when you say the Hanseatic League, you're talking obviously there about the, within this great and now almost sprawling EU, the relative power of Germany and the currencies of Northern Europe.
Not sure I exactly use the image of the Hanseatic League, but what I do think is that at the heart of this issue is obviously the position of Germany. Germany is Europe's central power. It is the economic engine of Europe. And the challenge of keeping Europe together is now at the door of Chancellor Angela Merkel. And for me, that is one of the great questions of the moment, which is how she will respond to that challenge.
Germans have obviously been very reluctant, starting with Greece, to kind of absorb everything here. They've looked at that as countenancing a kind of spending and debt that they don't practice and don't approve of. Is Germany going to save all this, Timothy?
Well, I mean, indeed. And what you hear in Germany is, are we going to have to work till the age of 67 so the Greeks can retire at 53? You can understand they're a bit upset about that. But what you have to remember is that the Germans were never actually asked if they wanted to give up their old currency, the Deutschmark. They were not asked. Chancellor Helmut Kohl, in the context of German unification, made that commitment to give up the old German currency. And a lot of Germans were always quite unhappy about that, but it was his way of securing German unification in the context of a larger united Europe.
You've written that at this point it is possible, it's conceivable, that the Eurozone can collapse.
Where does this stand? Talk about big.
So the problem is, as you know, that very different economies, very different countries, as different as Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and Germany, are tied together with a one-size-fits-all interest rate with a single currency. And they've been performing in very different ways, and now that is becoming a huge problem. And there are few examples in history where a monetary union has worked for a long time without a fiscal union, as you have, for example, in the United States, where you can have large transfers between states and you have a common tax base and a common fiscal policy. And therefore, in a sense, when we did the monetary union in Europe, we put the cart before the horse. And now the horse has to try and catch up with the cart.
So far, investors still see big question marks over exactly that. I mean, it really still boils down to whether Germany will backstop anybody and everybody in Europe, and they're leaving open a kind of an escape hatch there.
Well,
Germany is not, it's absolutely clear by now that Germany is not simply going
to sign a blank check. And if you remember, when Greece got into trouble earlier this year, the headlines in the popular German newspaper said things like, why don't you sell the Acropolis? That was their reaction to that idea. So the question is, will there be a package in which countries like Ireland, Portugal, Greece, Spain, have, as it were, German-type fiscal discipline, more budgetary discipline, which means that actually people will get poorer, in return for a guarantee of their sovereign debt by Germany, and, third element, bondholders, private investors in those government bonds, taking a haircut, taking some of the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of triple package which is on the table. And now one of two things happens. Either Germany and the rest get that package in place in time and the markets buy it, and all the countries in the Eurozone buy it, or the thing starts falling apart.
Greece has needed the bailout. Ireland. Now people are talking about Portugal, Spain, even Italy, even Belgium. Why those?
Well, let me tell you where we are, which is that it's pretty clear to me that after Greece and Ireland, both of which have had bailouts, we're going to move on to Portugal. The Portuguese are, of course, denying it, but most people assume that will happen. Now, the existing package that was negotiated in a dramatic night in May this year will cover Portugal, but it will not cover Spain, which is a large country in European terms, and it won't cover Italy. So if we get to Spain, then all bets are off. Then you have to do something new, and that is where the package I just talked about, which essentially makes the Eurozone a kind of fiscal union, not yet a full-blown state, but something much more than it is at the moment, would have to be put in place pretty quickly.
Is there a possibility that Europe can't handle its own bailout, that it has to turn elsewhere, the IMF, China, I don't know, Abu Dhabi?
Well, you say a possibility. It's already happened. I mean, the IMF was there in Greece and was there in Ireland. I mean, perhaps fortunately, there are many Europeans involved in the IMF, so that's already happening. But what is proposed by France and Germany is to have something which is like a sort of European monetary fund. So we do it ourselves.
And the idea that you and others have been kicking around, that the EU itself may change as a result of this, maybe be tiered in its membership. You've been talking about a Club Med periphery, a Celtic periphery, and around an EU core. I mean, what are the options here in this Rubik's Cube?
Well, here's the thing. There was actually probably a viable monetary union, which was what you might call the Protestant Monetary Union, a North European Union of countries around Germany which had a similar kind of North European Protestant ethic and fiscal discipline.
Netherlands, Austria, Finland, I don't know, maybe Estonia now?
Go on, yes. Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. Those sort of countries. And then, if you will, the Club Med. And what happened is that for political reasons, essentially, Club Med came very rapidly into the Eurozone. And just a few days ago, one of the captains of German industry actually proposed the solution in which the two should divorce. And you'd have a Club Med led, he suggested, by France, which could devalue its currency to become competitive, and this strong, in effect, Deutschmark zone, North European currency union. Now, economically, that would be much more viable. But politically, at this stage, having come this far, mm-hmm. to say to countries like Spain or even France and Italy, you know, you're out, mate, you're into a second-class club, that would have a hugely negative impact, not just on the Eurozone, but on the whole European project.
Not to mention, beyond money, and we'll talk about this after a break, but you're describing a Europe that's not only in trouble on the fiscal front, but its whole imprint on the world diminishing, the kind of courage of its place in the world diminishing on the back of these fiscal problems.
Well, listen, we all, you and us, are living in an increasingly post-Western world, where even the United States finds mm-hmm. that other people are beginning to call the shots, be it China or India or Brazil or Russia. So that's a common dilemma, but it's a dilemma that's particularly acute for Europe, because in order to hold its place in the world, Europe needs to get its act together.
Timothy Garton-Ash joins us, and we're glad to hear you're out of the cold there in Oxford. Journalist, scholar George Packer, The New Yorker, calls him an historian with a journalist's urge to be there and a journalist with a historian's knowledge of where he is, where we are. We're looking at the fate and future of Europe. Are you following the headlines out of Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain? Can Europe bail itself out? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fate, the future of Europe, the European community, the Eurozone, under now a wave of debt and rethinking. The great Timothy Garton-Ash is with us. The new collection of his essays from this past decade is Facts Are Subversive, Political Writing from a Decade Without a Name, winning raves all over the place, as he has for decades now. The Magic Lantern, back in the days of the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia and beyond. It's great to have him with us today. Simon Johnson joins us in a moment. Let's get our listeners right in. Aidan in Boston, you're on the air with Timothy Garton-Ash.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I just hear Timothy talking a bit about Germany, as if Germany was going to bail out Ireland at no cost. Like, as Germany put Ireland in this position by loaning money with no oversight, I feel like the Irish banks are now like the AIG of Europe. They're paying 100 cents on the euro to senior bondholders, and like it's bankrupting the country. And then the poor people of Ireland are getting like minimum wage cut back, unemployment benefit cut back, and all the paid, like Germany is getting paid back money it borrowed. They're senior bondholders, the French, the British, they're getting all the money back with interest.
Yeah, Aidan, let us pick it up right there. Timothy Garton-Ash, what do you say? It is pretty tough in Ireland now. Well, you hear Aidan's point.
It is very, very tough indeed for Ireland, which had had this dramatic transformation, had become a Celtic tiger, and one has great sympathy for people there. Having said that, I don't think you can blame it all on Germany and the German banks. For lending the money. After all, British banks also lent the money, and the banks that actually got into the greatest difficulty were the Irish banks themselves. But what is also true is that in the Eurozone, countries like Ireland or Portugal or Greece were able to borrow, indeed were encouraged to borrow, at unrealistically low interest rates, because investors thought that there was no risk to this sovereign debt, that basically they were covered by Germany and the rest. And that was a flaw in the design of the Eurozone from the very outset.
Aidan's point here, the comparison to AIG, that you know, the bankers are getting 100 cents on the dollar. Paul Krugman writing recently, facetiously, a little, I guess, headlining a column, Eating the Irish, saying, wait a minute, you know, the Irish people have been called on here, to, as Americans were, to step up and pay off these debts that were accrued not for public programs but for private profit, and now the entire country kind of yoked to that debt.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an absolutely fair point. But mind you, it's a problem that we all have in common, which is the question of what is the right approach to the banks and indeed to the bankers. Though I would say one thing, because we're talking very gloomily and pessimistically, but the truth is, if Ireland makes this kind of very painful adjustment, it'll come out of it in 5 years' time, like other countries that make these adjustments, that much stronger. So that at the end of the day, it's not impossible, if the whole thing holds together, that Europe emerges leaner and meaner and fitter.
What about the Krugman point that he follows on with, is that this austerity is not buying Ireland a way out. It's just digging a deeper hole. Of course, you know, maybe the UK is making a similar bet. I don't know. And the United States looking now at which way to go here. But what about austerity and the future? Do you believe? I guess you do. You're saying 5 years and it's back.
Do you know the answer? History is full of surprises, and no one is more surprised by them than historians. Nobody knows, not even economists. And we have this sort of great and very familiar argument between the Keynesians on the one side and the, you know, Hayekians and neoliberals on the other. Nobody knows how this thing is going to work out, and a lot of it depends on markets outside Europe.
We're going to hear in just a moment from one of those economists, Simon Johnson. One more call here first, Lexington, Kentucky. Dale, you're on the air with Timothy Garton-Ash.
Thank you, Mr. Ashbrook. Real quick, I'm a geologist. I work internationally, and I'm presently looking at my webpage, and there's a plethora of positions from headhunters in the UK and Sweden for oil and precious metal exploration all around the world, from West Africa to Mongolia. What role is that helping the problem? And my second question is two-part. Why did the UK not join the euro bandwagon, and was the euro, in hindsight, a mistake? I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you very much. I mean, first of all, that sounds a very interesting job. And, of course, countries like Britain and Sweden have very, very successful international companies. Now, as far as Britain is concerned, we stayed out of the euro mainly for ideological reasons, because a lot of Brits don't like the idea of, as they see it, a federal superstate in Europe. And the truth is that that was the right thing for us economically, because we've been able, as you know, to devalue our currency in the crisis and become more competitive. So that I think that for us, it was the right thing. Do I think the Eurozone was a mistake? No, I don't. I just think it went too far, too fast, and it wasn't well enough constructed.
We'll talk more about that. Timothy Garton-Ash joins us from Oxford, England today. His new book is Facts Are Subversive. With us as well, and we're happy to welcome him back, as economist Simon Johnson. He's professor now at MIT's Sloan School of Management, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. Simon Johnson, welcome back. Great to have you here with Timothy.
Nice to be with you.
So he's looking at the EU. The whole world is looking at the EU and the Eurozone and wondering if it lasts. He states the obvious, I guess, that it can collapse. How are you handicapping it at the moment? How are you seeing, you know, Europe's efforts to stave off a kind of domino effect, Simon?
Well, first, I heard Timothy say nobody knows the future, not even economists. I would say particularly not economists.
Okay, due modesty.
So let's start on that note.
Yes.
Look, I think what Timothy is also saying about something emerging leaner, meaner, and fitter makes sense. My question would be, what is that thing? Is it the Eurozone as currently constituted, which is 16 countries going to 17 in January when Estonia joins? Or is it a smaller, more cohesive group perhaps around Germany, perhaps countries that share certain values with regard to fiscal policy and so on, countries that will trust each other to have more of a joint fiscal policy going forward. And does that group include, I don't know, does it include Greece, does it include Ireland, does it include Portugal, does it include Spain? Where does that line get drawn?
Yeah, Timothy.
Yeah, it's absolutely the right question. And as you know as well as I do, the politics got too far ahead of the economics. And so, as I think I said a moment ago, in terms of economic policy, that would clearly be the right sustainable unit. The politics of going back to that now are pretty tough, actually. And in particularly if you're saying to very large countries and significant countries like Spain, Italy, and even France, your place is in division two. I think that has knock-on effects on the politics and the power projection of the European Union, which are very serious indeed. It may well come to that. It may well come to that. Sometimes history doesn't turn out as people hope, in fact, quite often.
Simon, we have a question here. Let me just put it to you. This is from online, from Branstad, who says, isn't any group of states doomed to failure when they have a joint currency and far differing economic systems and objectives? He writes, the joint currency locks the interstate financial markets, and when one state misbehaves, there's nothing the rest of the group can do but pay them off. I mean, is this workable on its face in its structure, Simon?
Well, it certainly leads to problems, as you're seeing today. I would point out, though, and Timothy can comment on this. Other Europeans certainly like to talk about it at length, that in the 19th century, the United States was a pretty disparate set of different economic spheres with very different values between, say, the East Coast and the Western frontier. There was one currency. There were lots of problems. There were debt defaults, by the way, at the state level with some regularity. There was not enough national debt for that to be an issue. And out of this, of course, developed a much more cohesive, unified country and a lot more labor mobility. And I think that that's the direction in which part of Europe is going and can go. But I would stress, just go back to what Timothy said a moment ago, France is the key. Because if you draw any kind of line around, let's say, a Germanic area of shared fiscal policy that doesn't include France, then aren't you calling into question the most fundamental premise of European integration, which is it's supposed to stop the French and Germans from fighting again, because they did that for a long time, and it was very bad for everyone.
Dr. Ash, what do you say?
I mean, absolutely, and imagine what the French would say to that proposition that they should go into the second division. So I think that's actually politically an absolute non-starter, and even now the Germans and the French are trying to keep the leadership of the European Union, although actually they're much less significant than they were in an EU of 6 or 9 or 12 member states. The labor mobility point is a really important one, because one could imagine this thing working somehow if, when Portugal or Greece plunge into crisis, 10% of the population upsticks and go and work in other parts of Europe where there are jobs available. As in the United States, people did upsticks and move from one state to the other. But as you know, that's not the European condition, because we speak different languages, we have very different cultures, and even though it's theoretically possible, it just doesn't happen on the scale that would be needed.
You say that divide, French-German, is an absolute non-starter. And for a long time, you remind us, Germans themselves have had the same message that Thomas Mann's mantra has been repeated, that they wanted to see a European Germany, not a German Europe, post-Hitler in particular, I guess. But, you know, inflation's also been an absolute non-starter for the Germans. Big debt's been an absolute non-starter. I mean, are you so sure that absolute non-starter isn't out there?
No, I'm not. And as a historian, one knows that no union, alliance, commonwealth in European history has ever lasted forever. So probably this one won't either. But I think there's still quite a lot of life in the old dog yet, I have to say. And I think there is, even though there's huge reluctance in Germany to pay for this, I think when it comes to the moment, when the car is hanging over the precipice with two wheels spinning, they will attempt to reverse. It may be too late, but they will attempt to reverse. Also because, you know, German businessmen will tell you, listen, this thing has actually been very good for us because we've been part of a very strong, stable currency, and our competitors inside Europe couldn't devalue competitively. Mm-hmm. So it's been very good for German exports.
Simon, why is the hammer coming down so hard on these EU members? I mean, if you look at the EU in total, they have a budget deficit of about 6% of GDP, public debts of around 84% of GDP. That compares to, you know, the U.S. is running a budget deficit now of over 11% of GDP. Its total debt's around 92%. I mean, our numbers are worse, but Europe's feeling the hammer.
Don't say that too loudly, Tom. The financial markets may hear you.
Sorry.
Seriously, it's all about the financial markets, and that's where I think you have to introduce this additional element into the calculation of the balance that Timothy's putting together for you, which is that when these financial markets are very big, there's a lot of debt outstanding, there's a lot of short-term debt outstanding, and the European leadership has completely misplayed their hand with regard to these markets. They don't understand that the markets are in a panic mode. They're selling out of Spanish government debt, and they will not come back in anytime soon. And there's a logic to that, which I think you have to go back to the 1920s to think about the way in which bondholders or outside investors or even domestic investors have these big effects on what's feasible and what's not feasible for domestic and international politics.
Let's get a call from Brattleboro, Vermont, and Tom. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, good morning. I'm trying to figure out what part the Federal Reserve plays in giving money to the Bank of England. That was kind of brought out this weekend. And I'm just wondering why, if that seems to be so strong, of a currency. And secondly, what part does the Bilderberg Group play in all of this? Because supposedly these are the big people that regulate the world, and it seems to be such a secret society. Thank you.
Tom, thanks for your call. Simon, I don't know about the Bilderberg Group. And what about the United States in all this? We saw when the Fed published where its money had gone post the crash that no small amount went to European banks. Is there an American role in the EU's struggling future here right now? And the Bilderberg Group, you tell us, Simon.
Timothy can explain the history of conspiracy theories around these kinds of issues. I don't believe in them myself at all. On the Bank of England and the foreign borrowing from the Federal Reserve, this is an interesting and important point. And what's particularly important, what we learned from the big Federal Reserve data dump last week, is that many European private banks, not central banks, private banks, commercial banks, and investment banks borrowed from the Federal Reserve to a very large degree. Now, this is extraordinary. Obviously, the circumstances were highly unusual. But it is very far from best practice for any central bank to lend freely to banks that it does not supervise. That's something you don't do for obvious reasons. You don't want to take their credit risk because you don't know what they're up to. And it's very important that while the financial crisis of 2008-2009 had an epicenter in the United States, the Europeans were very involved. And it's a global banking system, meaning specifically a transatlantic banking system that's got itself into a massive mess from which we have not extricated ourselves properly, and neither have the Europeans. That may be a bit more apparent right now in Europe, but these very same problems, for example, the same problems we've seen in Ireland, are coming our way unless we get ahead of this one.
Simon, we've just got you for another half minute. What would make you feel more confident that the dominoes will not come down in Europe? Portugal, Spain, Italy, Belgium?
They need a systemic and a systematic approach to the crisis, Tom. They like to muddle through. They like to go case by case. That's exactly the wrong thing to do with the financial markets seeing the world as they see today. You can't wish for a different world. You can't unhook yourself from the debt markets, not the way the politicians have been carrying on for the past 20 years. That they have to, I'm afraid, face the financial market music. And the financial markets will force upon them a comprehensive solution in which some countries stay in the euro and some countries perhaps don't. And some countries perhaps have to restructure quite a bit of their government debt and their big bank debt.
And just in a word, is there a lesson for the U.S. here?
Don't let the big banks get out of control. You will ruin yourself just as thoroughly as the Irish have ruined themselves.
Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, author of 13 Bankers, now at MIT Sloan School of Management, joining us from Washington. Simon, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fate, the future of Europe, the European Union, under a wave of debt and rethinking right now. Timothy Garton-Ash joins us from Oxford in England. His new collection of essays is Facts Are Subversive, Political Writing from a Decade Without a Name. You may know him from the decade of the Berlin Wall coming down, of the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, the Magic Lantern, and all the rest. He was right in the heart of it. Now he's looking at the heart of Europe's crisis. Been in the United States recently as well. We'll ask him about that. Timothy, speaking of the U.S., here's a question. It says, Tom, can you ask your guest to compare the debt of the pigs? This is Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, Spain, the sort of wobbly ones in the EU. Compare those, the debt of those, to state and local debt in the United States. What do you say, Timothy?
Well, actually, the pigs have slightly different structures of debt and deficit. So not all pigs are alike.
Mm-hmm.
But what's clearly the case is that the United States, if you take total debt, federal, state, and household debt, is carrying a huge debt burden, as, by the way, is the country in which I'm sitting, Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the broader lessons of this story is that, you know, our kind of free market economies have, over the last 30 to 40 years, built up this mountain of debt. And in a sense, it's gone from corporate to private, now to sovereign debt, to debt held by the state. Mm-hmm. And we have to massage that down. A successful growing economy can carry, you know, a fair old burden of debt. But when you reach that tipping point, which is what's happening to countries like Portugal and Ireland and Greece, when you reach the tipping point, when the costs of servicing your debt suddenly soars, then you're really in a mess.
Let's go to Omaha. And a lot of American states now looking at that and may see worse if interest rates go up.
That's exactly right. And we're competing, remember, I mean, this seems to be the larger point. We're mm-hmm. in a world where you have countries like China or indeed Germany, which have very high savings rates, which haven't built up these mountains of debt. And that's a competition. So I think that somewhere down the line, we do have to tighten our belts. We do have to take the pain if we're going to be out there competing through the 21st century.
Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska. Dennis. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hello. I would like to ask a question. It seems that Germany and England and Ireland and Portugal and Spain, it seems they all have more generous health care plans than we currently have. But is there something about the German plan that makes them more effective financially than the rest? And how do they compare to what we have now and what is coming down the road with the new Obamacare plan?
The question of social welfare generally, I hope you'll speak to healthcare in particular, Timothy, but a lot of Americans have looked to Europe, sometimes jealously, enviously, looking at the social welfare states there, other times shaking their heads and saying that can't last. Is there a message on all that in this time of trouble?
One of the things we really believe in is that you can combine a market economy with social justice, meaning, in particular, looking after the very poorest and weakest in society, something in which, by the way, Canadians believe too, and some of the federal states of the United States, though not all. That model is now very much under challenge for the reason we've just discussed, because of these mountains of debt, because of the cheap labor competition from Asia. And in our case, for another reason, because, as you know, most, particularly West European countries, have aging populations. And that means the burden of paying the pensions is going to come very, very heavy, and it's going to be carried by fewer and fewer native-born people. So absolutely key to this, here as in the United States, is successful immigration. I mean, that's to say, immigrants who are well integrated and who are therefore able to help carry the burden of that welfare state.
To bring a younger tier of labor into these countries, into these markets.
Well, absolutely, which of course is what's happening in the United States, and in particular you have the Hispanic immigration, and that's an issue. In our case, as you know, this gets mixed up with the issue of Islamism. and fears about Islamism, because most of our, particularly younger immigrants, tend to come from Muslim countries. So actually there's another big challenge to Europe there. We need that immigration, but we also need those younger immigrants to feel at home in Europe, to contribute to the society, and to abide by the basic rules of a free country.
I want to be sure that we get to this core point about social welfare and austerity. Are you saying that Europe will somehow figure out how to have both a good social safety net and austerity, or is it a...
We believe that you have to get smarter welfare states. At the moment, a huge amount of money is being wasted in our welfare system, and we can no longer afford that for all the reasons I've given. So we believe that you've got to have a basic social security net, as indeed Obama believes, as you have in Canada, but it's got to be much more discriminating, and you can't have these the absurdity of people spending their whole lives living off welfare, not contributing by working or contributing usefully to society, and having basically everything paid by the state. That is something we can clearly no longer afford.
But to our Omaha caller, is there a different German model there, let's say, when it comes to health care? I mean, they spend less than we do on health care, and yet they're covered and have good outcomes.
Listen, everybody spends less than you do, because actually, you know, America spends more than anybody else and gets not such impressive outcomes. So I'm afraid your system is rather crazy, if I may say so, in the nicest possible way. Now, the Germans, you know, a lot of this, you know, so many of these debates are a sort of great ideological battles, you know, socialized healthcare or not socialized healthcare. Actually, a lot of the story is about, is it well run? Is it carefully run? And, you know, the Germans on the whole are quite good at running things well and carefully. So they have a somewhat decentralized system of kind of provincial or state health insurance, which works relatively well and which a rich country can afford.
Let's go to Paul in Derry, New Hampshire. Paul, you're on the air with Timothy Garton-Ash.
Hey, how are you?
Good morning.
I don't know if you can tell from my accent, I'm originally from Ireland.
Hello.
But how are you, sir?
I'm quite well. Top of the morning to you.
Believe it or not, we don't say that.
I know. Anyway, I'm joking.
no problem. I blame the politicians for the state of Ireland today, because I believe they knew about this crisis a lot long before it actually occurred. The former Prime Minister, Taoiseach, as we say, Bertie Ahern, was advised by a lot of economists to tell him that this was happening. And one of the things that he said was these people should commit suicide, because he didn't want to upset the apple cart. And basically, he knew that if he started to tax more people, that he would lose the government, and obviously Fianna Gael or Labour would come into power. So basically, they sat on it. Obviously, you know about the Anglo-Irish Bank. The chief executive of the Anglo-Irish Bank basically had a $28 million euro loan that he kept borrowing, and just when the auditors came in, he would pay it off with a loan from another bank, and as soon as the auditors left, he would then take the loan back. So, and this guy is still living in his house in a very nice part of Dublin, and there's no responsibility for his actions, you know.
Paul, let us pick it up. Timothy, what do you say to this perspective Paul brings us?
I think that what is, that actually people always talk about Greece and Ireland and Portugal, but actually Ireland is different, because it wasn't the government directly which got into so much trouble. It was a failure to control those banks, which got just huge and completely out of control in proportion to their economy. So I think you have a good point there, actually. I very much hope that Ireland comes back, because in a larger perspective, it's been a fantastic success story the last 20 years for Ireland to be perceived as this enormously dynamic prosperous modern country, which is drawing people in rather than having people emigrate from it. That has been fantastic for the image of Ireland in the world. Also, by the way, for Irish-British relations.
But was it an illusion?
Did us a lot of good.
Was it an illusion? Was it based on an?
Well, I mean, an awful lot of what we saw. This is one of the themes of my book, by the way, mm-hmm. which is that in many ways, this last decade, which some people call the noughties, and quite mm-hmm. naughty they mm-hmm. were a decade of hubris. Of hubris in the United States, too, of mm-hmm. believing that, we were the victors of world history, riding tall, we could do whatever we liked. And these illusions, have come back to haunt us. And to some extent, we suffered that in Europe, too.
Let me ask you about forward-looking, the price of that, what it may mean. Europe has been not only an economic powerhouse for some centuries now, and then an imperial powerhouse, for better and worse, but it's also has come to stand for a certain set of values. And I wonder how those stand up as Europe's economy, its unity, get into this trouble. You've been writing not so long ago about, this week in Oslo, the Nobel Peace Prize is supposed to go to the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo. There's this question about whether EU ambassadors will show up for the event. China's pressuring them not to. You've said they should unanimously step up and say, we're coming. And in that, make a stand for European values, even as the economy there is in trouble. Is that going to happen?
I'm told that they are going to attend. I think it's the Chinese, Russians, Cubans, a couple of others who are boycotting it. Kazakhstan, I think, is boycotting it. But otherwise, I think the EU ambassadors are going to go. But you're absolutely right. We're being hard pushed to promote our values, which, by the way, in large degree coincide with those of most ordinary Americans or Canadians. There's not a huge gulf between our values. We're being hard pushed to promote them even in our immediate neighbors, countries like Belarus, which is a rather nasty little dictatorship, or in Egypt, or in Arab countries, let alone further abroad in Burma or China. And in order to do that, we have to get our own house in order because, you referred earlier to the magnificent experience of the Velvet Revolutions and the fall of the wall mm-hmm. and the unification of Europe. Now, the key to all of that was that Western Europe, remained strong, prosperous, free, and attractive. So if we don't get our own houses in order, and I mean America as well as Europe, and remain prosperous and attractive and dynamic, then China will be eating our lunch.
But you have made the case over time that human rights, as they've come to be perhaps generated or understood in Europe, are not specifically European values, that they're
Indeed.
Global values.
Indeed.
But, history and economics could test that pretty quickly. Maybe that's being tested already.
Well, I profoundly believe that that is the case and that actually, given the choice, young Burmese and young Chinese and young Indians would rather be free than not free and rather have the rule of law than not have the rule of law. And that's what many of them will tell you, too. But the way in which we talk about this is now very important. We have to say to young Chinese or Iranians or Indians, not these are the best values because there are values, because they're Western values, but these are the best values because they're genuinely universal values. These are the best ways for people to live wherever they are and whatever their tradition and culture is. And by the way, you can find these values in your own cultures too. So I think the terms in which we speak to an increasingly non-Western world are actually very important indeed. And the last thing we should do is to pull up our drawbridge in the fortress which we call the West.
You're an historian. How quickly can values turn around? I mean, you say that what happened in the Velvet Revolution was impossible in no small part because the economic strength of Western Europe next door. If that strength diminishes, You know, how fast does the yardstick of values change globally? It may not be the Burmese dissident or the young Chinese, but the Politburo in, you know, the...
You ask a very good question. You know, for most of the 20th century in Europe, three great ideologies competed for people's loyalty and support, and they were communism, fascism, and liberal democracy. And it was by no means clear that liberal democracy would win in the end, but it did. And the thing is, you know, someone traveled to Stalin's Soviet Union and said, I've seen the future and it works. Soviet communism looked modern back in the 1930s, and so did fascism. And now we have a new competitor, and it's not Islamism. Because Islamism, whatever you say about its appeal to young Muslims, does not look modern. That's not the real competitor. What is the real competitor, and this is a great theme of my book, is authoritarian capitalism, as you see it in a country like China. And we see a country like China, which is modern, dynamic, successful, growing faster than us, but doesn't have democracy. And that's the competition we face.
We've got just half a minute. You've been in the States recently looking at change in Silicon Valley. You say it happens there at the speed of science. But in Washington, you describe change happening at the pace of Brezhnev's Soviet Union. What does the EU need from the U.S. now? What does the world need?
Well, it needs you to get your own house in order. I have followed this. I come to the United States for 3 months every year. I followed this with growing distress and concern. The paralysis of your gridlocked politics are not good for the United States, and they're even less good for the world.
Brezhnev's Soviet Union is the model you see in Washington?
Well, perhaps a slight overstatement there, but then you know the first law of journalism. First simplify and then exaggerate.
Right, and hopefully, before it's all over, come to some insight. You always help us do that. Timothy Garton-Ash, has been great having you with us. Timothy Garton-Ash's new book is Facts Are Subversive, Political Writing from a Decade Without a Name. Thank you so very much for being with us from Oxford
today. Great pleasure to be with you.
Good luck over there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.